Kim closes her eyes and nods. Men don't know, she thinks. They don't know how having a baby makes you protective of your skin, your body, your space. When you spend all day giving yourself to a baby in every way that it's possible to give yourself to another human being, the last thing you want at the end of the day is a grown man wanting you to give him things too. Men don't know how the touch of a hand against the back of your neck can feel like a request, not a gesture of love. How emotional issues become too cumbersome to deal with. How their love for you is too much sometimes. Just too much. Kim sometimes thinks that women practice being mothers on men until they become actual mothers, leaving behind a kind of vacancy. D.I. McCoy leaves a minute later. He promises that he will open an investigation. He doesn't say when or how. Kim watches him from her front window, climbing into his unmarked vehicle, adjusting his rearview mirror, adjusting his lanyard and his suit jacket and his hair, turning on the engine and leaving. She turns to Noah, who is in his bouncy chair, a mushed-up rice cake in the palm of his hand, and she forces a sad smile, designed to distract him from the tears running down the sides of her nose, and says,
"Where's Amma, Noah? Where is she?"
Chapter 13, August 2018. Sophie leans down to read the inscription on a small wooden plaque beneath the rose bush behind the bus stop. It says, "Tallulah Rose, until we meet again." She stands straight again and glances around herself, looking for the window at which poor Tallulah's mum might have stood, watching her girl waiting for her bus to school. There are no houses directly opposite the bus stop, but there is a small cul-de-sac set just off the other side of the common, very close to Maypole House. From here, Sophie can see the glint of sunlight off windows. She crosses the common again and heads towards the cul-de-sac. It consists of about 6 houses, set in a half moon around a small patch of green, cars parked half up on the pavements to make room for other cars to squeeze past. The houses themselves are small, post-war dwellings, with rendered fronts and wooden porches. She turns and looks back across the common, trying to ascertain which of the houses might have a view of the bus stop. 2 of them appear to. One of them seems quite run down. The other looks bright and modern, with cacti and copper pots in the window, and a brown leather sofa covered in brightly coloured cushions, just visible against the back wall. The article said that on the night they went missing, Tallulah and her boyfriend had been drinking at the Swan and Ducks, the local gastro pub that had been recommended to Sophie and Sean by Peter Doody the day they arrived. Sophie carries on circling the common until she finds herself outside the pub. It's very attractive, freshly painted in heritage shades of grey, a gravelled front area with round wooden tables and chairs, huge cream parasols and chalkboard signs advertising the menu and the beer selection. She pushes open the door. It's classic gastro pub. Tongue and groove, funky abstract art on the walls, designer wallpaper, reconditioned floorboards and halogen spots. The woman behind the bar is 40-something, attractive in an unconventional way. She's wearing a fitted black cap-sleeved t-shirt with black trousers and a bartender's apron tied tight around her waist. Her dark hair is tied back in a ponytail. As she approaches Sophie, she rests her hands against the bar, fixes a smile and says, "What can I get you?" "Oh, just a cappuccino, please. Thank you. Coming right up." She turns towards the big chrome coffee machine and Sophie notices the tattoos on the undersides of her arms. At first, she thinks they might be burns or scars. Then she sees that they are baby footprints. "Your tattoos are really cute," she says. "The baby feet." The woman turns and Sophie sees her smile fade a little. She glances down at one of her arms and touches the image of the foot gently with her other hand. "Oh," she says. "Thanks." She carries on making the coffee. The hiss and splutter of the machine is deafeningly loud, and Sophie doesn't attempt to continue the conversation. Her gaze drops to the woman's feet while she waits. She's delicately built, but wearing somewhat incongruous scuffed leather army boots. Something twitches in Sophie's memory. She's seen those army boots before. Recently. Really recently. And then she remembers. The pictures in the village newsletter of Tallulah's memorial procession. The mother had been wearing army boots with the pretty floral dress. The woman turns with Sophie's cappuccino in hand. Chocolate on top? She asks, with aloft the canister. And Sophie sees that it is her. It's Tallulah's mother, Kim Knox. For a moment, she is silent. Yes, no? Says the woman, waving the canister. Sorry, yes, please, thank you. The woman sprinkles the chocolate powder over the coffee and slides it to her. Sophie feels inside her handbag for her purse, barely able to make eye contact with Kim Knox, feeling as though she's about to be caught out in her snooping around. She pays using her contactless card and takes the coffee to a small purple velvet armchair set next to a low brass coffee table. From here, she watches Kim Knox restocking the shelves with Fever Tree tonic waters. She has an odd energy about her. She looks as if she weighs no more than 9 stone, but her movements are those of someone heavier. A young man walks into the pub and heads towards the gap in the bar. Hi, Nick, she calls after him as he passes through. He calls out, Morning, Kim, before disappearing through a door at the back of the bar. So it's definitely her, Kim Knox. The man reappears a minute later, tying an apron around his waist and then rolling up his shirt sleeves. Want a hand? He asks her. Sure, she says, scooting along a little to give him space. Sophie drops her gaze and pretends to be looking at her phone. She wonders how long Kim's worked here. She wonders if she was working here the night her daughter disappeared. There's so much she wants to know, wants to ask. She feels the tendrils of her fictional South London detective duo, Susie Beats and Tiger Yu, start to thread their way through her psyche. When she's writing, her brain comes up with mysteries and Susie and Tiger have to solve them for her. That's how it works. And Susie and Tiger would have no qualms about approaching this sad, pretty woman and asking her questions about what happened to her daughter. They would just do it, because it was their job. But it's not Sophie's job. She's not a detective. She's a novelist. And she has no right to invade this woman's privacy. When she leaves a few minutes later, Kim Knox smiles. Have a good day, she calls out, leaning to collect Sophie's empty coffee cup from the bar where she left it. Yes, says Sophie. You too. Sophie hauls an old bike out of the shed attached to their cottage, rids it of cobwebs and dead leaves, and cycles out towards Upley Fold. After a hazy morning, the sun is now starting to break through the cloud. The hedgerow smells of cow parsley and dead straw, and the air is heavy and warm. She dismounts the bike outside the house and crunches across the gravel driveway towards the front door, where she cups her hands to the glass and peers into the hallway. There's a small fan of mail spread across the front doormat and a gap under the front door with a brush strip attached to the underside. She delves into her rucksack, her hands searching for the wire coat hanger she'd put in there earlier for this very eventuality. She gets down onto her knees and slides it through the brush strips. It hits something. She gets lower to the floor and manipulates the hanger and the object until she thinks it might be close enough for her finger to locate it. And then she tugs it gently, and there it is. An envelope. It's a letter addressed to Mr. Martin J. Jacques. She breathes a sigh of relief. Jacques. An unusual name, a good name to put into Google. She takes a photograph of the letter and then gently pushes it back under the door. The time is approaching 11 o'clock. She has another few minutes, she reckons, to snoop about before heading back to the village for her lunch with Sean. She circles the house, heading through the pretty wrought iron gate with the arched top that leads to the back garden and the swimming pool. She peers through windows. She goes into a greenhouse and lifts up feather-light plant pots, watches spiders scuttling into corners. There's a small rusty trowel on the wooden bench, and she slips it into the outside pocket of her rucksack. She has had an idea. The arrow on the piece of cardboard nailed to the fence points down and slightly to the left. She has no idea if "dig here" is a precise instruction or a general suggestion, but she starts digging as close to the tip of the arrow as she can. She has butterflies as she digs. Her blood is filled with the adrenaline of dread. 14 months ago, two teenagers went missing somewhere between Dark Place and the village, possibly somewhere in these woods. The sign that appeared so innocuous 2 days ago, the sign she'd thought a leftover part of a team-building exercise or a treasure trail, the sign that she still feels so strongly she has seen somewhere else, at some other juncture of her life, now carries a shadow of potential horror. Might it be a shred of torn clothing? A tiny shard of bone? A hank of hair tied in faded satin ribbon? She holds her breath as the trowel goes deeper and deeper into the summer dry earth. Every time it hits a stone, she inhales again. 9 minutes later, the tip of her trowel dislodges something small and hard. A dark cube. She pulls it out of the ground with her fingertips and dusts it down. There is a gold logo stamped onto it, impossible to ascertain what it is exactly, and as her fingers feel around it, she realizes that it is a ring box. She pulls it apart with her thumbs. Inside is a perfect, gleaming, golden engagement ring. Chapter 14, January 2017. College restarts and Tallulah is glad. Christmas Day was nice, Noah's first. Her dad, whose name is Jim, came down on Boxing Day, only the second time he'd seen Noah since he was born. He stayed in a room above the Swan and Ducks for 2 nights and even paid for them all to have dinner there on the 27th. He was hugely taken with Noah and sat him on his knee and stared at him in wonder and called him the bonniest baby he'd ever seen. Tallulah's father was normally very self-centred and distant, but becoming a grandfather seemed to have removed a layer of protection from around his heart. But the Christmas magic soon dissipated, and the novelty of seeing Noah in his Christmas elf outfit wore off, and on New Year's Eve, she was to stay home alone while her mum went to the pub with a group of friends and Ryan went to a party. It was one of the first moments that Tallulah felt stifled by the responsibilities and limitations of motherhood. So when Zach offered to come and sit in with her that night, as much as she didn't want him to get the wrong idea and think that they were on again, she also didn't want to spend the night alone with a 7-month-old baby. So she said yes. He arrived at 9 p.m, fresh from a friend's house, smelling slightly of beer and cigarettes, his hood up against a cold wind, his hands stuffed inside his pockets with an off-license carrier bag looped over his wrist. She held the door ajar so he could come in, and he leaned towards her for a quick peck on her cheek. "Happy New Year," he said. "Not quite," she said. "Is Noah in bed?" He glanced up the stairs. Tallulah nodded. "Been down for a while." "Sorry I'm a bit late. They didn't have what I wanted at the co-op, so I had to go into the pub for it. Had to queue for ages. Packed in there." He opened up the bag and let her peer inside. Champagne, still cold from the fridge. She smiled. She couldn't help it. She loved champagne. "Saw your mum," he said, following her into the kitchen.
"Oh yeah."
"Looked like she was having fun."
"Good,"
she said, sliding the champagne into the fridge and pulling out 2 beers.
"Got crisps as well."
He pulled out 2 bags of tortilla chips and a jar of salsa. "And these, because I know they're your favourites." He presented her with a bag of Cadbury's mini fingers. She smiled again.
"Thank you," she said.
They settled in front of the TV with their beers and the crisps. It was the first time she'd been alone with Zach in weeks, in months. Usually he came over during the day to spend time with Noah when he was awake. She'd thought it might feel a little awkward, but actually it didn't. She and Zach had known each other since they were 14 years old, when he started at Tallulah's school after moving from a boys' school in the next village, where he'd been bullied. She'd befriended him because he looked nice and she'd felt sorry for him. And then they'd started dating, and that was that. They were one of those teen couples that were part of the furniture. An unsurprising couple, not one to create chatter or intrigue. So maybe it wasn't so strange that Tallulah should have felt so comfortable in his company that night. They'd been friends, they'd been lovers, they'd been ex-lovers, and now they were parents. There was no reason why they shouldn't be able to be friends again. They didn't talk much that night. They let the telly entertain them. They looked at their phones and showed each other things that were amusing. At one point, Zach snatched the phone from Tallulah's hand and said, "Here, I want to see your camera roll. Let me see." "Get off," she'd laughed. "Why?" "Just want to see photos of Noah," he said, and she let him scroll through her phone, and it was nearly 100% photos of Noah. But then the roll got as far back as the Christmas party at college, and Zach slowed down and started looking at the pictures in more detail. "You look nice," he said, zooming into her face in a selfie she and Chloe had taken just before they went home. "You're wearing makeup." "Yeah," she said. "Just eyeliner. Mum did it for me." "Suits you," he said, turning, giving her a strange look. "Not like you to get all dolled up. And who's that?" he asked. "It's a selfie taken on the dance floor at the Christmas disco when she and Scarlett had been dancing to Mariah Carey. Scarlett must have taken it." The camera was held up high, both of them beaming with all their teeth on show, pieces of glitter just starting to fall from the netting overhead, catching the light. "That's Scarlett, a girl at college." "You look really happy," he said, zooming in on their smiles. "I kind of thought you'd forgotten how to smile like that." She made a dry sound of laughter. There was something accusatory in the tone of his voice, as if she'd somehow let him down by being happy. "Yeah, well," she said. "They were playing Mariah. You'd have been smiling too."
"Just never think of you as the party type," he continued, and she felt herself starting to tense up.
This, she thought, was why she didn't want to get back together with him. Having a baby had changed her. It had changed everything about her. Leaving school had changed her. Being single after 3 years in a couple had changed her. She wasn't the soft, romantic girl she'd been before she got pregnant, before he'd walked away and left her to cope on her own. And she knew, deep down, that that version of Tallulah Murray was the only one that Zach was really interested in being with.
"Well," she said, "things change, don't they?"
"I guess," he said.
And there was a note of sadness in his voice. At a few minutes before midnight, they took the champagne out of the fridge and a pair of wine glasses and went into the garden. The next-door neighbour's cat sat on the fence, curled into its haunches, eyeing them curiously before turning to look up into the sky. It was cold, and Tallulah shivered slightly. They'd had a couple of beers by then, and when Zach put his arm around her shoulders to warm her up, she didn't shake him off. They used their phones to count down to midnight, and Zach popped the cork, and they heard people all around them cheer, and cars hoot their horns, and fireworks pop and splutter in the blackness of the sky, and they held their glasses of champagne aloft and said Happy New Year to each other and hugged. As they pulled away from each other, Zach looked as if he was about to kiss her, and she thought, "No. No. I don't want to kiss you. I'm not sure I'm ever going to want to kiss you again."
"Oh, fuck Tallulah," Zach said. "I wish I'd never done what I did last year. It's like the greatest regret of my life. You know that, don't you?"
She nodded.
"Will you ever forgive me?"
He threaded her hands into his.
"I already forgave you," she said. "I forgave you ages ago." "Then why?" he said. "Why can't we start over?" I don't know. I just don't feel like I want a relationship right now. Noah, he's enough for me."
She felt his grip tighten around her fingers.
"But Noah," he said, "he's ours. We made him. That makes us a union, a team. It's not just about our relationship anymore, is it? It's about all three of us.
You get to see him all the time.
Yeah, he sighed impatiently. I know, but it's not the same. Not the same as being with him 24/7 as a family.
Yes, and that's not what I'm saying. Obviously, it would be better for Noah if you were here all the time, but I don't know if...
She paused, buying time to find exactly the right words.
If it's right for me.
He laughed, slightly dismissively.
Lula, he said. For fuck's sake, we've known each other since we were 14. We know we're right for each other. Everyone knows we're right for each other. Please give me a chance.
But where would we even live?
Here, he said. We could live here. You've got that big bed. Your mum loves me. Ryan loves me. I tell you what.
He countered quickly, clearly sensing her lack of enthusiasm for the idea.
Let's do a trial run, yeah? Maybe I could stay over one night. Nothing like that, he reassured her. I'd sleep on the floor. Imagine Noah's face in the morning, waking up and seeing Dad there, and I could do his morning feed and let you have a lie-in, yeah? Wouldn't that be good?
He smiled down at her, using her hands to pull her closer to him, so that their stomachs just about touched, their faces just an inch or two apart, his eyes boring deep into hers.
Wouldn't it?
He said again, kissing her knuckles, looking at her coquettishly, a lazy half-smile on his lips. And something inside her gave way at that moment, a kind of sinking feeling in the pit of her stomach, paired with a swoon in her groin, a feeling of wanting to be touched by someone, but not by Zach, of wanting to be wanted, but wanting to be left alone, all at the same time, and she saw Zach's mouth move towards hers and found herself moving towards him, and then they were kissing, and all her misgivings fell away in a moment, all her ambivalence crystallized into a single longing for him, for it, for flesh, for limbs and mouths and all of it. Within a moment, she was against the back wall, her arms and legs wrapped around him. And it was all over in under a minute. And it was what she wanted. It was what she wanted so much. And he carried her afterwards, still inside her, her arms and legs still wrapped around him, and twirled her round and round the garden. And she was smiling, properly smiling, the blood pumping through her, the moon shining down from the velvet sky. And when Zach said, I love you, Lula. I love you so much. She didn't stop for even a second before replying that she loved him too. Because right then, for that moment in time, she really did. Chapter 15, June 2017. D.I. McCoy leaves Kim's house at about 10 a.m. And at around 11 a.m, a call comes through on Kim's phone from a number she doesn't recognise. She assumes that it must be him, that it must be the detective, that there is news, an update, a development of some kind, and her heart immediately begins to gallop and adrenaline pumps hard through her body.
Yes? Oh, hi, is that Kim Knox?
It's a girl's voice.
Yes, speaking.
This is, Mimi, Scarlett's friend. She said you wanted to talk to me.
Oh!
Kim pulls out a dining chair and edges onto it.
Mimi, thank you. Are you able to talk?
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted to know, Kim begins. I mean, I've already spoken to Scarlett and her mother and to Lexi, and none of them has a clue what happened on Friday night. But I just thought that maybe you might have picked up on something, something that nobody else picked up on, that might explain what happened after Tallulah and Zach left.
There's a brief silence and she can hear Mimi inhaling, pictures her drawing on a cigarette clutched between the knuckles of skinny fingers with bitten down nails.
I mean, Mimi begins, literally the only thing I can think of is that they might have had a fight.
Kim's head rolls back slightly.
Fight? Yeah, they seemed a bit, I don't know, like... There was something going on between them, a bit of tension. Kim swivels towards the dining chair and moves the phone to her other ear.
Like what? She says. Can you describe it?
Mimi sighs. I went indoors to charge my phone, she says. Lula and Zach, they were sitting in, like, the little room just behind the kitchen. It's like a snug kind of thing. They didn't hear me go past, but I kind of peered through the gap in the door and I saw he had his hands really tight around her wrists and she was trying to get them free and he just kept them pinned down, like he was trying to stop her hitting him or maybe trying to stop her leaving. I don't know. He looked really angry.
Kim blinks slowly. Mimi's words slot into the space in her head where her own misgivings have been gestating, the place where she wonders how Zach might have reacted to a rejection. As they do so, she feels a jolt of nausea pass through her. The what-if starts to take shape, and the possibility of Zach having played some part in her daughter's disappearance overwhelms her for a moment.
Did you hear either of them say anything about a ring, maybe, or an engagement?
There's a solid pause on the line, and then...
No, nothing like that. They were both quite quiet, really. To be honest, I wasn't really sure why they were there. I didn't feel like they even wanted to be, you know?
Sunday never ends. Instead of putting him down in his cot, Kim takes Noah for a long walk around the village in his pushchair for his daytime nap, her eyes scanning every hedgerow, every alleyway, and crevice between houses. As she passes Maypole House, her eyes go to the back of the grounds where the student accommodation is. She thinks of Scarlett's ex-boyfriend, Liam, the only person who was there on Friday night whom she has not spoken to. But she's sure, as Lexi had said, that he didn't see or hear anything more than she had, as he left early with her. A moment later, she finds herself outside the Swan and Ducks. The front terrace is heaving, as it always is on a sunny Sunday lunchtime. Prosecco on tables in wine coolers, jugs of Pimm's, children in high chairs being fed chopped-up sausage and mash by mums in floaty dresses with sunglasses on their heads, cockapoos curled underneath tables in the shade. Kim wheels the pushchair through the throng and into the bar where it is cool and overcast. There are fewer people in here, and she goes straight to the bar. She recognises the young guy behind the bar. It's Nick. He's an out-of-work actor who likes flirting with middle-aged men just to watch them blush.
Hello, you, he says. Don't normally see you here during the day. What can I get you?
Oh, she says. No, not here for lunch. Just wondering, you were here on Friday night, yes?
As it happens, yes, I was. They worked me like a dog.
And Meg's told you about my daughter and her son.
Yeah, that's right. Did they get back okay?
No, she says, her voice threatening to crack. No. She draws her breath in hard and regains control. They're still not back. I've reported it to the police now. I guess they'll want to talk to you at some point. Ask you what you saw.
Oh, God, Kim, that's terrible. You must be worried sick.
Yes, she says, squeezing out a strained smile. I really am. But I just wondered what you saw exactly.
Well, not much, really, I'm afraid. They started off over there.
He points to a nook at the back of the bar.
All cosy and lovey-dovey. He bought a bottle of champagne. They had the seafood platter. They were so cute. And then there was this other group, a kind of Maypole group, you know, loud in your face. And I think they knew your daughter and sort of infiltrated your daughter's nice romantic evening. I felt really bad for them.
Noah starts to stir in his pushchair and Kim rocks it a little, absentmindedly.
Did you see anything strange happen?
Strange?
Nick turns and fixes his lighthouse beam of a smile on a customer who has appeared at Kim's side. He takes their order, then he switches back to Kim a moment later and says,
I wouldn't say strange, no. Lots of drinking. And given the amount of cashbacks the Maypole kids were asking for, I suspect maybe a drug delivery of some kind. But I didn't see any evidence of that. And then it was closing time and they all just left. And that was that. He looks at her sadly and says, "Fuck him. I'm sure they'll be home any minute now. They're bound to be. You know what teenagers are like."
She carries on walking. She goes to Tallulah's friend Chloe's house just outside the village, the last in a row of small flat-fronted cottages with doors opening directly onto the main road. Chloe says no, she hasn't spoken to Tallulah in ages. But she also says something interesting when Kim mentions that Tallulah had last been seen at the house of Scarlett Jacques in Upley Fold. Chloe's eyes narrow and she says, "Weird." Kim says, "Why?" Chloe shrugs. "There's just something off about Scarlett and that lot. Something, I don't know, dark. And there was this night last year, the college Christmas party, when I was sitting with Lula and Scarlett sort of took her away, kind of rude. And I can't really explain it, but it was like Lula already knew her, even though she didn't. And they were dancing for a while, and then they went outside for like about 10 minutes. And Lula was all on edge when she came back in. Couldn't really work out what it was about. I mean, as far as I was aware, Scarlett and that lot are just this uber clique. Never speak to anyone. Yet she spoke to Lula. It was weird. Anyway, Lula and me didn't really talk again after that." Kim grimaces. "After the Christmas party?" "Yeah, I mean, we say hi if we see each other, but we don't hang out." "But what about in February? When you were going through the thing you were going through?" Chloe gives her a blank look. "You were feeling really low and Tallulah came and spent the night with you." "Are you sure you mean me?" "Yes, back in February, Tallulah told me you were really low and she needed to spend the night with you in case you did anything stupid." Chloe shakes her head. "God, no. No, that definitely never happened. I did not feel low and she did not stay the night. I promise you, Lula and I have barely said a word to each other this year. We've barely seen each other." "It sounds like she might have been lying to you, to be honest." Chapter 16, September 2018. The grounds at Maypole House fill slowly but surely during the weekend before term begins. The empty buildings come alive with the movement of people, the sounds of voices and music, of doors opening and shutting, ringtones and car engines, laughter and shouting. Sophie feels strange, less like she's in the middle of nowhere as she'd feared, and more like she's actually in the middle of everything. From the garden outside the kitchen, she can sit and watch the students leave their rooms and head into the main building for breakfast. Some of them take morning jogs around the grounds. She starts to recognise certain faces, certain groups of friends, and she can tell even from a distance who is new to the college and who is a returner by the confidence with which they traverse the school grounds. On the Sunday night before term officially starts, there is what is called the Registration Day dinner. Registration Day is the busiest day in the run-up to the new term, when the majority of students arrive from home to board and sign up for their classes. In reality, most of this is done online before the students ever set foot on campus. But it's an old tradition, and it's a good way for students to set eyes on their classmates before they hit the classroom. And then there is the dinner, which, according to Sean, is what it is really all about. In days gone by, it was a sit-down affair. But since the new accommodation block was built 10 years earlier, doubling the size of the student population, the dinner has morphed into a party with a buffet and a DJ. Sophie, for some reason, wants to look stunning for the party. Not just nice, but knockout, drop-dead amazing, so that the students will all talk about her behind her back. So they'll say, "Wow, Mr. Gray's girlfriend is really pretty, isn't she?" She wants, for some reason, to win the approval of some of the handsome-looking boys she's seen jogging around campus. Not the young ones, obviously, but the 19-year-olds, the nearly men with their summer tans and their thick hair and their swaggers. She pulls on a satin camisole top with lace trim and a lace-panelled back. She teams it with fitted black trousers and high-heeled black sandals, and she fixes her hair into a side ponytail that sits on her shoulder. She blobs her face with things that promise to illuminate and to shimmer.
Sean does a double take as she walks into the hallway. He says,
God, wow, Soph, you look lovely.
And she can tell he means it. The noise from the main hall is deafening. It has a barreled wood-lined ceiling and windows set up so high they only let in light, no view. But there are three pairs of huge double doors open onto the lawn where there is a marquee and tables and chairs laid out in the early evening sun. She and Sean wander across the lawn together, her arm linked through his, throwing smiles at people and stopping to say hello. They find an empty table, and Sean leaves Sophie to go and get them drinks. Her gaze travels across the scene as she waits for him to return, to the cluster of lovely young things curled around each other in little pockets, impenetrable, slightly terrifying, the power and yet the patheticness of them, the know-all and know-nothingness. It's not just their youth that glitters, she ponders as she watches them. It's their backgrounds, their innate privilege, the suggestion in the way they touch their hair, the way they hold their drinks, the way they scroll so nonchalantly through their phones. They come from places that aren't like places most people come from, and they have the high gloss veneer of money that shines through the scruffiest of exteriors. Sophie comes from terraced houses and cars that drive till they die, and state schools and weekly Tesco shops and biscuits off plates at her grandma's flat every Saturday. She hadn't missed out on anything. There was always food and holidays abroad and shopping trips to Oxford Street and takeaways on Friday nights. There was always enough of everything. Her life was perfect, but it was matte, not gloss. She thinks about Dark Place, about the Jacques family, about the swimming pool that must once have sparkled icy blue in the summer sun, the art that must have once sat on the perspex plinths, the music that must once have tumbled out of double doors and across the manicured lawns, the especial laughter of people with numerous cars and horses and chalets in the Alps. Their daughter, Scarlett, had once been a student here, according to Kerri-Anne Mulligan. Sean reappears with two glasses of wine and takes his seat next to Sophie. Sorry I took so long, he says. Got waylaid. Let's drink these, she says, and then we can mingle.
Oh, God, do we have to?
He says, dropping his forehead against her bare shoulder. She ruffles the back of his neck and laughs.
I kind of think we do have to, yes. You're basically the king. You have to get out there. I know.
He lifts his head and puts a hand on her knee.
I know.
They drink their wine and within a minute or two are joined at their table by a couple called Fleur and Robin, who are the geography teacher and the photography teacher, respectively, and who live in a cottage just outside the village and have a border terrier called Oscar and a rabbit called Bafta, and are both very talkative indeed. Halfway through this conversation, they are joined by a middle-aged man called Troy, who has a magnificent beard. He is the philosophy and theology teacher, and he lives on campus, has a lot of recommendations for local delicatessens, wine shops and butchers. Someone whisks Sean away, and for a while it is Sophie and Troy, and that is fine. Troy is very easy to talk to, and then they are joined by someone with a French accent and someone with a Spanish accent, and soon her table is overrun with people whose names she barely has time to catch, let alone their job or roles at the school. Then she notices a younger man, standing at the periphery of the group that has gathered around her table. He's holding a beer in one hand. His other hand is in the pocket of a pair of navy chino shorts. His brown hair is short and wavy. He's wearing a white shirt with sleeves rolled up to just above his elbows and white trainers without socks. He has a nice physique. He looks a bit like a film star, one of those ones called Chris. Sophie can never remember which is which. He's talking to an older woman. Sophie can tell he doesn't know her all that well, that he's making an effort to be charming and polite. She sees him turn very vaguely in her direction, as though he can feel her eyes upon him, and she looks away. The next time she glances over, she sees that the older woman has turned to talk to someone else and left him adrift. He lifts his beer bottle to his lips and takes a thoughtful slug. He sees her looking at him and smiles,
You must be Mr. Gray's partner, he says, approaching her.
Yes,
she says brightly. My name's Sophie. Lovely to meet you. He passes his beer bottle to his other hand and offers her his hand to shake.
Great to meet you too. I'm Liam. I'm a classroom assistant here. I work with some of the kids with special needs. You know, dyslexia, dyspraxia, that kind of thing.
He's well-spoken, but there's a kind of rough Gloucester undercurrent to his accent.
Oh, that sounds really interesting.
He nods effusively.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's not like my life's ambition or anything. It's just temporary. But for now, it's really, really satisfying.
So, what is your life's ambition then?
Oh, yeah, right.
He passes his hand around the back of his neck and screws his face up.
Haven't quite worked that one out yet. Still trying to find one, I reckon.
He smiles.
21 going on 15. Failure to launch.
He sounds apologetic, and Sophie finds herself reassuring him.
No,
she says. You're working, you have a really important job. That's more than a lot of men your age these days.
Yeah, he says. Maybe.
Then he says,
so, what do you think of Maypole House?
She glances around and nods.
Yes,
she says.
I like it.
It's not what I'm used to. I mean, I'm a Londoner, born and bred. I've never lived outside London before, so country living is a bit of a shock to the system.
Oh, this isn't country, says Liam. This is not country, believe me. I was brought up on a cattle farm in Gloucestershire. That was country. This is just a nice place for people to live who don't want to live in cities.
Sophie smiles. Fair enough, I guess. Then she says, how long have you been teaching here?
Well,
he smiles sheepishly.
I actually used to be a student here, believe it or not. I was sent here by my parents when I was 15 to do my GCSEs because I was getting too, distracted by other things in my old school. And then I liked it here, so I stayed on to do my A-levels. Failed them all. Retook them. Failed one. Thought about retaking it. So yeah, I was a student here for...
He narrows his eyes as he makes the mental calculation.
4 and a bit years? It might possibly be an all-time record for the Maypole. Most students aren't here for much longer than a couple of years, and now they can't get rid of me.
He laughs and Sophie laughs too. Then she says, so you must know a lot about the place, about its history.
I am the world expert in Maypole House, yes, that's about right.
So if Sean needs to know anything, you're the man to talk to?
Yeah, I guess so. Just send him my way. I'm his man.
So, you were here last summer? She begins carefully. When those teenagers went missing?
A shadow passes across his face. Yeah, he says. I was here then. Not only that, but I was there.
Sophie starts.
There?
Yes, at the house, the night they disappeared. I mean, I was friends with Scarlett, the girl who lived there. I didn't see anything, obviously. I didn't know anything. But yeah,
shocking times, really.
Shocking times.
He changes tack swiftly to Sophie's frustration.
And what about you? What do you do for a living? If you were in London, did you have to leave your job or...
She shakes her head.
No,
she says.
No, I mean, I was once a classroom assistant, like yourself, in fact, at a primary school in London. But now I'm self-employed. I can work from home. So nothing much has changed for me in that way, you know?
Though to be perfectly honest, I haven't quite managed to get back into any kind of discipline yet. I keep getting distracted by things.
She laughs lightly, but actually she's worried by how, after nearly a week at Maypole House, she hasn't written a word of her latest book.
Every time she opens it up and begins to type, she starts thinking about Tallulah Murray and Dark Place and Scarlet Jacques and the rose bush across the common and the pink baby feet tattooed on the underside of Kim Knox's arm.
and the engagement ring in the dusty black box hidden inside her makeup drawer. She thinks of Martin Jacques, whom she Googled after snooping on his mail. Thinks of the man she saw online, tall and haggard with a quiff of thinning steel hair and a stern expression. The man who is described on LinkedIn as the CEO of a Guernsey-based hedge fund and is currently, according to another Google result, living alone in Dubai, having separated from his wife. She found no mention of his ex-wife or grown-up children on any page of the internet, but the separation seemed the obvious explanation to Sophie of why Dark Place had been abandoned and left to rot. "Oh well," says Liam. "I'm sure once the college gets into a routine, you will too." She smiles gratefully. "That's a very good way of thinking about it," she says. "Thank you. You're very wise." As she says this, she sees Sean appear over Liam's shoulder. She's struck for a second by the contrast between them, the 20 years that divide them. Sean looks, for all his handsomeness and charisma, old enough to be Liam's father. "Hi," he says, putting a hand out to Liam. "Liam, isn't it?" "Yeah, that's right. Good to see you again." They conclude that they've already met, and the conversation becomes diluted with other people and other topics, and soon Sophie is no longer talking to Liam at all. He's been absorbed into another group. She finds herself alone and walks across the lawn towards the bar inside the marquee. Here, she gets herself a second glass of wine and carries it back outdoors. She can just see Sean across the lawn, deep in conversation with Peter Doody and Kerri-Anne Mulligan. Then she sees Liam walking across the lawn towards the main hall, and on a whim, she follows him. He carries on walking through the hall and out of the doors on the other side. Then he crosses the back courtyard and heads towards the accommodation block. She sees him tapping the security code into the panel and, with a buzz and a click, he's gone. She sits on a bench in the courtyard, glad of a moment to herself before going back into the fray. The wine is warm, but she drinks it anyway. The evening sun is strobing through ribbons of purple cloud, and she turns her face into it, her eyes closed, listening to the distant din of chatter and laughter. She shudders slightly to right herself, and then she opens her eyes, and, as she does so, she sees a pair of tanned feet overhanging the bars of a balcony on the third floor of the residential block, the edge of a paperback book, a cold beer sitting on a table. It's Liam. For a moment, she toys with the idea of calling up to him, of inviting herself in, of drinking a cold beer with him and asking him what he thinks really happened at Dark Place that night. She shakes her head to herself. Then she heads back through the cloisters to the party. Chapter 17. January 2017. Zach spends the night with Tallulah on New Year's Eve and never goes home. When Tallulah wakes up for her first day back at college 5 days later, she awakes in a bed shared with her baby and her baby's father. She and Zach haven't had sex again since New Year's Eve, but they sit side by side on the sofa at night and they kiss each other goodbye and hello, and they hug and they touch. Tallulah's mum is pleased. Tallulah knows that she's always felt guilty for marrying a man who wasn't cut out for the hurly-burly of family life, who ran back home to his mum the minute she said she needed him and left them all behind without a glimmer of remorse. And Tallulah can tell that she is pleased that Tallulah and Zach are going to make a go of being a proper family and that Zach is going to relieve some of the pressure on Tallulah as a single parent. Tallulah kisses her mum goodbye on her first day back at college. In the front garden, she looks up and sees Zach and Noah at her bedroom window. Zach holding Noah's tiny hand up, and waving it for him. She sees him mouthing, "Bye-bye, Mummy. Bye-bye, Mummy." She blows them kisses and then walks away. At the bus stop, she finds herself looking for Scarlett. Scarlett never appeared at the bus stop again after that first time, and Tallulah didn't see her to talk to after the Christmas party. But for some reason, Scarlett has left an imprint on Tallulah's psyche. Their two interludes feel important to Tallulah.
and she feels like something is meant to happen now. A third act. A conclusion of some sort. The bus arrives. She takes one last look across the common towards Maypole House, sighs, and gets on board. After lunch that day, Tallulah decides to visit the art block. She's never been in the art block before. It's a squat square building in the middle of campus, kind of ugly. The corridors inside are decorated with rows of slightly alarming self-portraits. She finds a door towards the end of a corridor that says Year 1 Fine Arts and peers through the window. The room is empty but locked. She passes through more corridors lined with more art and then finds one that is labelled as Scarlett Jacques, Year 1. Tallulah stops. It's a portrait of Scarlett in a crop t-shirt and oversized shorts draped inside a huge red velvet throne-like chair, wearing a tiara at an angle, high-top trainers, her hair scraped back, hoop earrings and wrists layered with rubber bands. At her feet is a gigantic brown dog, almost the same size as Scarlett, also wearing a crown. Both of them stare directly at the viewer, the dog looking proud, Scarlett looking challenging. It's an arresting image. It draws the eye first to Scarlett and then to every other detail, a pile of silver and cream chargers on the floor catching the light. A small window behind with the suggestion of a face staring as though watching her. There's a gun on a table, an Apple phone, a dish with a fresh red heart in it that looks as if it's still beating. On another table, there's a cake with a slice missing, and the knife used to cut it has a drop of blood on it. Tallulah has no idea what any of it means, but it's beautifully painted, all in sun-bleached shades of pink and green and pale grey with shocking slashes and spots of red. She finds herself mouthing, "Wow," to herself. "Amazing, isn't she?" She turns at the voice behind her. She thought she was alone. It's one of Scarlett's gang. She can't remember her name. "Yes. I mean, I haven't seen her work before. But this painting is incredible." "You know she left?" Tallulah blinks. Feels a kind of tightness in her stomach.
"What?"
"Scar's gone. She's not coming back." The girl makes a kind of popping noise with her mouth, as though Scarlett were a bubble that had burst.
"But why?"
"No one really knows. I keep messaging her and she keeps saying she'll tell me when she can. But she can't tell me right now, so, yeah." Tallulah turns back to the painting.
"What a waste,"
she says. "Yeah," the girl agrees. "She's a fucking idiot. All that work and all that talent and she's just walked away from it. But there you go, that Scar, an enigma, wrapped in a blanket." She smiles. "You're Tallulah from the bus, aren't you?" Tallulah nods. "Mimi, we met at the Christmas party."
"Oh, yeah, hi."
Mimi cocks her head at Tallulah and says, "Are you doing art?" Tallulah shakes her head.
"No, I just fancied looking at the art. Someone said it was really good."
Mimi looks at her curiously for a moment. Then she pulls her heels together, straightens up and says, "Anyway, time to get on. And if you see Scarlett around your neck of the woods, tell her to stop being a fucking dick and get in touch, will you?" Tallulah smiles.
"I will," she says. "I promise."
After that, Tallulah looks for Scarlett every time she leaves the house. She knows that Scarlett's boyfriend Liam is a student at Maypole House, so it's more than possible that Scarlett would be in the village from time to time. Every now and then, Tallulah flicks through her photo roll to get to the picture of her and Scarlett at the Christmas party and tries to remember the way she'd felt that night, the person she was when she was under the red-hot glow of Scarlett's attention. She Googles Scarlett's name from time to time too, idly, just in case she's ended up in the newspapers somehow. She doesn't know where Scarlett lives, just that it's somewhere walking distance from the village, which could be anywhere. There are at least three hamlets near Upville Common, and the roads between are peppered with private driveways leading to the sorts of big houses that Tallulah imagines Scarlett to live in.
And then one day during the last week of January, Tallulah sees Scarlett getting out of the passenger seat of a smart car parked outside the co-op on the high street of the village. She's wearing what look like pyjamas, with her fake fur coat over the top. Her hair is straggly, and she's wearing beaten-up trainers over fluffy socks. In the driver's seat of the car, Tallulah sees a young man. He's staring at his phone and there's the dull thud of music emanating from the car. A moment later, Scarlett emerges with a carrier bag and jumps back into the smart car. The boy in the driver's seat looks at her briefly, turns his phone off, and drives the car towards the road that goes to Manton. Tallulah stands, watching it disappear as though it might carry some clue as to its final destination. Then she remembers something. Her mum had mentioned a few days ago that she'd seen Keziah, one of Tallulah's best friends from primary school, working at the co-op. Tallulah hasn't seen Keziah for months. Last time was when she was just starting to show in her pregnancy, and Keziah had put her hand to Tallulah's bump and made a sound as if she was about to faint because she was so overawed by it. Keziah's behind one of the tills when Tallulah walks in a moment later. Her face lights up when she sees her.
"Lulah," she says, "where have you been hiding?"
Tallulah smiles and shrugs. "Tend to do big shops now," she says. "With the car, easy with all the nappies and formula, you know." Keziah smiles warmly at her.
"How's the Baba?"
"Oh, he's amazing," she replies.
"Into everything, I bet."
"Not yet. He's too young for that. But he's mellow anyway, you know. He's a little Buddha."
"At home with your mum?"
"Well, yeah, my mum and Zach."
"Oh," says Keziah.
"I thought you two had..."
"Yeah, we did. And then we got back together again, around New Year."
Keziah beams at her.
"Oh," she says. "That's amazing. I'm so pleased. You two were made for each other."
Tallulah smiles tightly.
"It's nice," she says. "Nice for Noah and nice to have another pair of hands, you know."
"You look really different," says Keziah.
"Do I?"
"Yeah, you look kind of, I don't know, really grown up, really pretty."
"Oh," says Tallulah. "Thank you."
"You should come out one night with me and the girls."
"Yes, I'd like that."
She's not sure she would like it. She's always thought there was a reason why she hadn't stayed in touch with her friends from primary school, but has never been quite sure what that reason might be. Something deep-seated and subconscious, something that even now makes her feel strange when contemplating the idea of a reunion.
"That girl," she says, "who just came in wearing pyjamas, do you know who she is?"
"The skanky one, you mean?"
Tallulah shakes her head slightly, trying to align the way she sees Scarlett with the way someone else might see her. And then she says,
"Yeah, the one with the furry coat."
"Yeah, that's the girl who lives at Dark Place."
"Dark Place?"
"Yeah, you know, that big old house in Upley Fold."
She shakes her head.
"You must know it," Keziah says. "It's like the biggest house in the area."
Tallulah shakes her head again and then says,
"What did she buy?"
Keziah scoffs a little.
"Why do you want to know that?"
"I don't know. She's just... I kind of know her from college and she left really mysteriously. No one knows why and I'm just being nosy, I guess."
"She bought rum, rolling tobacco and tampons."
Keziah rolls her eyes. "She's such a skank," she says.
"Did she say anything?"
"You're kidding me, right? As if someone like her would make conversation with the checkout girl at the co-op."
She tuts and then her eyes drift across Tallulah's shoulders to a customer waiting to be served.
"Better go," she says. "Love to the Bubba. Bring him in next time so I can see him, yeah?"
Tallulah smiles.
"I will, promise."
She walks home slowly, Googling Dark Place on her phone with one thumb as she goes. A wiki page pops up for what looks like a house out of a fairy tale or a ghost story. Her eyes scan the text and she catches fragments of a story about coffee plantations and Spanish flu and assassination attempts and people having their eyes pecked out by crows. She wonders why the house isn't famous or open to the public, how a place like that could just be a family home, the place that Scarlett lives, where she is headed right now with her tobacco and her rum and her packet of tampons. Curiosity suddenly swamps her, and she crouches down to feel through her rucksack for her college planner. She flicks it open to the back page and scans the contacts listed there until her finger hits Scarlett's name. Before she can change her mind, she words an email. "Hi, Scarlett. This is Tallulah from the bus, just checking in. Hope you're okay. See you around. Love, T." She presses send before she changes her mind, puts her planner back in her bag, and heads home to her baby. Chapter 18, June 2017. Kim calls D.I. McCoy at 8 o'clock on Monday morning. He answers within a few rings.
D.I. McCoy?
Oh, hi, sorry to call so early. It's Kim Knox from Upfield Common. I wondered if you had an update about my daughter, Tallulah Murray.
Ah, yes, hi, Kim.
She can hear him flipping through papers in the background.
Sorry, we've not got anything to report right now, I'm afraid. We've been over to the house in Upley Fold. We've spoken to the family there, but there were no leads as a result of that. We're heading into the village right now. A couple of my officers are going into the pub. More paperwork being flipped. Swan and Ducks to talk to the manager there, see if they can shed any light.
But the woods, says Kim. Are you going to send anyone into the woods? Because, you know, it's still possible they're in there somewhere, that they decided to walk back when they couldn't get a taxi and that something... They might have fallen into an old well or something, or...
She draws in her breath. She can hardly bear to bring herself to say what she's about to say, but she has to, because it's relevant. It's important.
Maybe they had a fight, she says,
the words all tumbling out on top of each other.
Scarlett's friend Mimi, she told me she saw them having an argument at Scarlett's house. Apparently Zach was being a bit physical with Tallulah, had her by the wrists.
She hears D.I. McCoy fall silent. The papers stop ruffling.
Right, he says. And that sort of physical aspect. Was there a lot of evidence of that between them? From what you could see at home, I got the impression from our chat on Sunday that they were quite lovey-dovey.
There it is again, lovey-dovey. The same expression Nick at the pub had used yesterday to describe them. She sighs.
Well, the thing is, he is. Zach is lovey-dovey. He's the romantic one. Tallulah, I often felt, was just putting up with it, that she'd rather be left alone. But no, I never saw anything physical between them.
Never heard anything behind closed doors?
Nope, nothing like that. I mean, Zach has a quick temper sometimes, but never with Tallulah, never with the baby.
So what?
D.I. McCoy begins, and Kim can hear the creak of a chair as he moves position.
What do you think might have brought about the row Tallulah's friends said she saw them having on Friday night?
Kim's mind goes back to the engagement ring in Zach's jacket pocket, the conversation Ryan recalls having with Zach about the idea of him proposing to Tallulah. It feels like such an intimate thing to share with a stranger, as though she's giving away a bit of Zach's heart. But she has to tell the detective. It might, as she can't stop thinking, be the key to everything.
On Friday morning, she begins hesitatingly, I found something in Zach's jacket pocket. A ring. It looked like an engagement ring. A diamond in a gold band. And my son Ryan says that Zach had mentioned something vague about proposing to Tallulah. And yesterday I was talking to the barman at the Swan and Ducks and he said that Zach and Tallulah had been drinking champagne that night before they hooked up with Scarlett and her gang. And it's
possible, you know, that he asked her and she might have...
She swallows.
She might have said no.